book of Exodus was going along pretty well until we got to last week's portion. He was telling us the story of coming out of Egypt, telling us the story, the plagues and the splitting of the sea, and all that's great and all that's interesting and all that's important. And then we got up to the Ten Commandments. After the Ten Commandments, we have a whole bunch of laws, which most likely are the ideas of the Ten Commandments being elaborated upon, being spelled out. And then we have the sudden stop last week, which deals with issues of construction. This week continues with the construction, although if I had to give one major difference between last week's portion to this week's portion, last week spends more time on building the building, and this week spends more time on the people who will be functionaries within it, namely the Kohanim, and the various clothing which they're going to need when they go and they do the work inside. And there's a couple of different ways of analyzing this. One is to take each piece, break it down, analyze it, understand its literal meaning, understand its symbolic meaning, and then trying to put the whole thing back together again. And there are great advantages to doing that. The biggest disadvantage is the amount of time that it would necessitate to really do that properly. I want to speak today in much more general terms. And one of the things which strikes me as interesting is the very idea of the uniform. That the Kohen, when he's going to go inside, needs a certain type of uniform, a certain type of clothing, to be able to go inside. Now, we come from a generation which is decidedly informal in terms of its modes of dress. Although, I mean, most of you don't see it, that the way that you dress is also a uniform, but it's the, right? Because you think that you're choosing how you want to dress, but of course your choice is based upon what everyone else is doing. And therefore you've chosen a certain type of an informal dress, but it's still uniform. So just in case you feel good about it, don't feel so good about it. The idea of wearing something specific is interesting. Let's at least start and see where we can go with this. When I look at last week's portion, the one thing which strikes me more than anything else is this idea that in the temple, in the Mishkan, later in the Beis HaMikdash, in the Holy of Holies, we're told that the Ark is going to stand. Now, I want to just pause there for a second. The deeper understanding of building a building like this is that at one point in history, there was one particular place which was the holiest place in the history of the world. But what's fascinating, it didn't retain its holiness. Not only did that place not retain its holiness, we don't even have in our historical consciousness a clear identity as to where that particular place is. Can you imagine that Mount Sinai, at the moment that the story was unfolding, that place became the epicenter in terms of spirituality? The very heavens open up right above that building. The heavens open up, God speaks, the people hear or they see God's sound. And then, just as the heavens open up, they shut down. Now, one of the reasons for this, and of course this is the kind of thing that you can analyze on many levels, one of the reasons for this is that the location that this took place was not meant to be a holy location on a permanent basis. Now, that may seem very obvious to you. Where was this? Well, as I said, I don't know the answer. Where it was exactly? Where was it generally? Someplace in the middle of the desert. Why was it necessary to have this in the middle of the desert? And that's a very good question. Do you realize that's a very good question? When the Jews left Egypt, they could have traveled directly to Israel. It wouldn't have taken all that long. Matter of fact, if you take the coast and come up the coast, they could have hit a place called Aza within a couple of days. And right from there, enter into Israel and so on. They weren't ready. The inhabitants of Israel weren't ready to leave.
The Jews weren't ready to fight for the land yet. And for some reason, it was deemed necessary that the revelation would take place in this more anonymous place, a desert, a mountain in the middle of the desert, a place without boundaries, a place without ownership, a place which becomes remarkably democratic in terms of people being able to lay claim to it. The desert is a place which is just wide open. And the same way that it would be absurd for you to walk in and say, that's my grain of sand. No, it's the whole thing is the desert. And maybe that's part of the message in terms of how Torah is going to be acquired. But as I said, what's interesting is what happens next. Is that that momentary experience now needs some type of a permanent display. And there God says, V'asu li mikdash, make for me a sanctuary, make for me a holy place, v'shachanti b'tocham, and I will dwell within them, within the people. Which basically, to paraphrase a shorter way of putting it, God says, if you build it, then I will come. So the whole idea, and again, this is essential, because I could have said to myself, hold it a second, before you build the temple, is God homeless? Is God sleeping on some park bench? Yesterday's newspaper for a pillow? It's absurd. It's not that God is homeless. It's not that God needs a home. But God says, if you build it, then I will come. V'asuli mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham. But when even God says, I will come, he doesn't say that I will come and dwell within the house. I will dwell within you. That already gives us the secret to what all this is about. It's ultimately about bringing divinity down from the heavens and bringing it into us, into our lives. And that, by the way, is incredibly difficult. And we also realize now that there are stages. And the first stage necessitated a desert. Because otherwise, why don't you just say, build a temple and I'll show up in the temple. But then it continues to tell us that the voice of God will emanate from the ark. Now, you stop again. What happens at the revelation? Revelation's a micro situation. What happens at the revelation? God speaks the Ten Commandments. Now the Ten Commandments will be etched in stone and will be placed within the ark. And what does God say? You'll build this ark and you're going to put something on top of the ark, which I'll get to in a moment, and then the sound of God will emanate from on top of from the ark in between these two gold pieces. Which means the sound of God, which was emanating on Mount Sinai, will now start emanating from within this building itself. So building this building is in order to create a situation that the divine, that the holiness, that God can be manifest. And what happens when God is manifest? We take God into our lives. So it's all about us needing God. The description of those two things which are made, which are standing on top of the ark, is quite remarkable. Because what it says is that these things are called kruvim, cherubs. Kruvim, we're told, are made of one piece of gold, but they end up looking like two forms. And based upon all kinds of rabbinic interpretations, we're understand, based upon actually verses, we are led to understand that the two cherubs are childlike or infant-like. One is male and one is female, and they face one another. And they're on top, and they're naked, and they're on top of the ark. Now this itself is potentially very disturbing. Do you understand why it's potentially very disturbing? Yeah?
It seems immodest for like for something that's so holy.
See, he's very kind because he used only the word immodest, yeah?
Seems idolatrous.
It seems idolatrous, yeah?
Can I agree with that?
So it seems idolatrous and it seems pornographic. Can you imagine if the wrong person gets a look of this, of what the Jews have stashed away in their temple? I say, look what the Jews have. And the sound of God will emerge from this particular place. So, I need to, apparently I need to explain this a little bit. The procedural answer as to why this is or is not idolatrous will be remarkably unsatisfying. What makes something idolatrous, or how do you call idolatry in Hebrew? avodah zarah, a strange service, doing work which God did not call upon. What is the definition of a mitzvah? Something that God commands you to do. So when God commands you to make these things, what does it then become? A mitzvah. Didn't I tell you this would be unsatisfying? Which means I could really phrase the question a little bit differently. I can ask, what's the difference between the golden calf and between the golden cherubs? Or let's flip it around. Let's say instead of making a golden calf, the people made golden cherubs. Would that have been completely different?
But there's still something the matter. I mean, I accept your answer, but there's still something the matter. Because let's just say God said, okay, and inside the temple in the Holy of Holies, you put two golden calves. Would we feel much better now? As I told you, I gave you a procedural answer, but it's not wonderfully satisfying. Correct. So I'm saying your answer is just as unsatisfying as mine. You're right. It comes down to a technical point. This God said to do, and this God didn't say to do. Maybe we all need to take in a little bit of humility and say, okay, that's it. That's the bottom line. But I think that there's something more to this. Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. And that's what you were saying as well. The intention over here is wonderfully important. And but by the way, let's keep another thing in mind. These cherubs, which are inside the Holy of Holies, are never going to be seen. With the exception of on the holiest day of the year in Yom Kippur, then they'll be seen by the high priest. But you have to realize that that's circular. But see, your point is correct. But now you're telling me that why is it of significance? Because God said to do it. So therefore, why is it good? Because it's a mitzvah. So what it really comes down to, it easily could have been the other way around, the golden calf versus the cherubs. One God said to do, one God didn't say to do. Yes. Very good, very good. Last week, yeah. And who told you that? Good. Which rabbi? Which rabbi told you this?
Well, it's not a rabbi, it's an Orthodox. Not a rabbi, I had him, but he's
doing, he's my parasha every week. Yeah, so what do you say? Good, good. I agree with you, I agree with him, and I want to say something even more than that. Because that was very good, but ultimately you'll see it's there's more depth, and we need to understand the depth. Depth is very important. Yeah. By the way, what's interesting about what both of you are saying, I don't want to brag more than necessary, but I wrote a book, which is a commentary to the Torah, and I published it around 6 years ago, and at the point that I wrote this, I didn't find anybody else making the point that both of you were really spelling out a little bit. I believe that the two cherubs represent Adam and Eve before the sin. Okay, I said the same thing that both of you said. I told you, I just said it a little bit deeper. And no, it's okay. You guys are good. But I want to explain to you what I mean by that and also show you why I said it. But I want to get back to this week's portion as well. But now you'll realize why I had to go there in order to come back. And I'll also make an observation in terms of methodology so that you can see that there's actually some kind of a reason that I'm saying this, and it's just that I can throw out anything I want. When you want to search for something and find significance of something, there's value in finding the first time that something is mentioned in the Torah. The first time the cherubs are mentioned are not in last week's portion. The first time the cherubs are mentioned, what?
In Genesis,
right after the Jews are exiled from the Garden of Eden, the cherubs are guarding the path back to the Garden of Eden. Which means when God created the world, He created Adam and Eve, and you know what? I'll just throw out another thought over here, just so that I can clinch my argument, so that I can convince you that I'm right. Remember, I told you the two cherubs were made out of one piece of gold. Adam and Eve were originally made out of one piece. So therefore, the two cherubs made out of one piece of gold represent Adam and Eve, which are made out of one piece. By the way, the problem of being kicked out of the Garden of Eden, and there's many problems of it. But the problem of being kicked out of the Garden of Eden causes a distance between man and God, but it also causes a distance between man and his fellow man, or man and his wife, or woman and her husband, and it also causes a distance between man and himself. Which is, fundamentally, we have three relationships. We have a relationship with God, a relationship with our fellow man, and a relationship with ourselves. I'll add that it's very difficult to have a relationship with your fellow man unless the relationship with yourself is healthy. If your relationship with yourself isn't healthy, it's very difficult to form a real relationship with somebody else. Certainly a relationship of equality. A relationship of just taking is possible, that you become somebody else's object of good deeds, that's possible. Or the object of someone else's pity, that's possible. But when you build yourself up and you're strong and the relationship that you have with yourself is good and powerful and healthy, then you're enabled to have a really good and powerful relationship with another person. And people who try to, certainly to try to create a marriage when they themselves are broken, will have a very difficult time forming that relationship. Now let's go back a second. God in the Garden of Eden created one being. That one being is called Adam and Eve. God takes that being and separates it into two bodies. God then tells that being that they are to search for their other half and to join together. So therefore realize the profound message of sexuality in Judaism is a physical expression of joining together, which manifests itself in a physical way, but it also manifests a spiritual interconnection. It's one soul being divided into two bodies, which is joined together and becomes whole again. So this idea of being made out of one piece of gold, just like there's one body called Adam and Eve, is the natural situation. So therefore, for Judaism, the sexual relationship with the person who is the soulmate is the most natural relationship in the world, because it's not even a relationship with another. It's a relationship with two people who are the same, who are merging together and creating the real proper situation. Is what I just now said clear? I think I just now said that. I just said that. Now, what happened when Adam and Eve ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil? And by the way, let's get this very, very clear. What was the tree called? The tree of? Right, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Meaning the PR, like Madison Avenue, is going to try to package it as the tree of knowledge. But it's not the whole thing. A tree of knowledge could be very good. A tree of knowledge of good and evil, that's a little frightening. But especially if it means a tree of knowledge of good and evil, where good and evil get confused between one another and you no longer know which one is good and which one is evil. What is possible before eating from this tree, everyone knew what is good and everyone knew what is evil. What happens after you eat from it? Now you can convince yourself that what you thought previously would have identified as evil is really good for you. That's what's scary about it, because it's a combination. Yeah. And then they couldn't tell anymore which was good and which was bad. Good. So let's go slowly now. Let's go slowly. Yeah.
It seems to be more like it's a tree of lack of knowledge of what is good, what is evil. So there won't be any confusion there.
So part of the issue is, what does the word knowledge mean? Because there's all kinds of different intellectual processes. There's wisdom, there's understanding, there's knowledge. It's not all the same. So chachma, wisdom, chachma, the Kabbalists tell us, is koachma, understand how something works. Understanding is insight. Knowledge is based upon experience. It's learning based upon experience, but experiences are very subjective and experiences can lie to us. So therefore, for a lot of people, they cannot understand something unless they had an experience. But because their experience may be somewhat stilted, their entire understanding of something could be stilted. So one has to be very careful, because it's not objective knowledge. Chachma, koachma, is objective understanding of something. So the tree of knowledge is a tree of experience, which is, of course, how is it approached? By taking and by eating. Let me see how far I can get with this. Let's go on a little bit more. You all already alluded to it now. What happens after they take in this knowledge? The result is very interesting, because the result immediately which is felt is, first of all, they notice that they're naked. So beforehand, they weren't naked? So what happened before? Which brings me back to, I want to go back to what you said before. You used a wonderful word. The word you call, you word you used was innocence. You know, I'm a rabbi. I don't know anything about art. I don't know how to paint. I certainly know how to sculpture. I can read. But if I were an artist, what I would see the challenge of making a picture of Adam and Eve, what would be the biggest challenge in terms of drawing them? Yeah.
Conveying innocence in adult faces.
Conveying it. And I think if I had to find one part of them that I had to convey that in would be their eyes. What do you make those eyes look like? Those eyes which are an hour old. See, the bodies are easy. These people are born that day, but God obviously created them at some kind of a greater potential. They didn't look one day old in terms of their physical form. So you can say they created at a physical apex. They were created with, you know, physical strength, physical form, and you can say that Adam and Eve, that moment they created, that first day where they're frolicking about, that they are physically mature, but they still have an innocence to them. And that innocence, again, I would say that it should be captured by that look in their eyes, that I don't think an artist can possibly draw it, because I don't think an artist has ever seen it. And again, to say a child today even, it's still not even the same thing. How do you look in the eyes of somebody where the world is brand new, where there's no cynicism, right? Where they're not jaded, and they never even saw anybody who was cynical. See, that's the problem with looking at kids today. The kids little kids today, even, we can say, oh, they're so nice and so innocent, but do you realize what those poor little kids have seen? Listen, just with the internet today. Nice, innocent 8, 9, 10-year-old kid. They can see more than your grandparents ever imagined seeing in their lives. And you can look at them and they may still look innocent. Their innocence is very different. But it's more than that. Even you look at a kid who's 3 or 4 or 5, do you know what the problem is? They've looked into our eyes. They have to deal with us. They have to deal with us coming home after a tough day and talking in a way we shouldn't be talking, or treating them in a way which they don't deserve. Which means the child may have innocence and may deserve all kinds of things, but there's a big bad world out there, and they're victims in it. When you go back to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, the day of creation, they never looked into the eyes of an elderly person who was tired of living. They never looked into the eyes of a middle-aged person who life has sort of pushed them aside and said, we don't need you anymore. They never looked into the eyes of disappointment, of hunger, of loneliness. They saw a beautiful world. How do you draw eyes like that? How do you capture that? That's what the Holy of Holies had. The Holy of Holies had the cherubs, which again, I believe are Adam and Eve before the sin. That's why I said it's so much more than the way that somebody explained it to you. So now you know why I had to write a book. It was so much more because it contained within it a type of an innocence that, again, I don't know to what extent we have the ability of even imagining it. Now, what happened at the moment when they ate from that fruit? That moment they realized they were naked. So what does that then tell you? That the feeling of nakedness, the feeling of being uncomfortable with your body, the feeling of the sense that maybe you fall short compared to expectations or whatever someone's telling you the perfect body is supposed to be, and all kinds of other things that go with it, that hits them all right at that moment. And there's probably a great deal of embarrassment, humiliation, and anger. But what's really telling is that they also feel at that moment that they need to hide from God. the voice of God comes out, which teaches us an unbelievable lesson. We could sin. We then hide from God, and God remains unchanging, and the voice of God is still there speaking to us, gently calling us, Adam, Eve, where are you? Come back home. And what do Adam and Eve do? They cover themselves up and they try to hide from God. You know, a number of years ago, I once wrote an article, and I wrote something about eating meat in the Jewish tradition. It was based upon something later on in the Torah about the people desiring meat and eating meat. And somebody who apparently is the head of the world Jewish something for vegetarianism wrote me an email. And he said that he found my article and he found it very interesting, but then he decided that he was going to challenge me. I think he thought he would convert me. And he said to me, but weren't Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden vegetarians? So I wrote back to him, they were also naked. What's your point? What exactly are you advocating? But there's a much deeper idea. Do you understand what it is? How are you comparing yourself to Adam and Eve? Adam and Eve at that moment where they can't eat an animal, I'm not even saying they're on a higher level. You're talking about a quantum different level in terms of who they are and in terms of what they need to consume and in terms of how they need to live their lives. And their idea of kosher meant they can't eat a particular fruit. I don't know what free world they didn't have. But what I do know is that their diet isn't all that important to me, as neither was their clothing all that important to me, because what you're talking about is such a different level of human existence, and maybe it's really a metaphor for the point that we die when our souls lose its clothing, right? What's a body? A body is clothing for the soul. Why? Maybe your soul would feel really, really uncomfortable if it had to walk around without a body. Do you understand what I'm saying? In this world, our souls need bodies. That's its clothing. And we would feel so humiliated if every single person saw the full aspect of our soul. Did you get what I'm saying or not yet? We live in a generation that people are more willing to take off their clothing and show their bodies than share their souls with one another. Sharing your soul with one another? That's humiliating. That's frightening. Because you know what you have to do in order to get there? First, you have to understand your soul. First, you have to work hard to understand it, to identify it, to know it, and then to feel comfortable enough to feel a lack of vulnerability that you're willing to share it with somebody else. And very frankly, most people are absolutely terrified of that. Again, much easier to take your clothing off than to take off the real clothing, which is the body, and to reveal the soul. But there's another thing that happens when Adam and Eve sin. And this is something the rabbis point out. What would you do if your spouse did something which caused you to be evicted? And let me finish the sentence. From the Garden of Eden. We're not even talking about a country club here. Right? We're talking the Garden of Eden. Can you imagine what the eviction from the Garden of Eden can do to a relationship? According to the rabbis, they couldn't speak for the next 130 years. Because on the one hand, you're saying, well, this is great. Adam lived for 970 years. You know what happens when you live for 970 years? You can get embroiled in a 130-year fight and not want to make up. 130 years, they were separate, which means that when Adam and Eve are hiding and they think they're hiding from God, they're ultimately hiding from themselves. And they're ultimately hiding from one another. Now, once they leave the Garden of Eden, they have to put on clothing. Anybody know in Hebrew how you say the word clothing? Begadim or beged. What does the word beged mean? What's the root of the word? So you say it means clothing. Bet gimel dalet. What does it mean? It also means a betrayal, a rebellion. Begida. Which means clothing is the symbol of the rebellion that we have against God. Right? What's the matter?
I know, it's a crazy explanation you're giving to get in.
You good now? Clothing is what we use to hide who we really are. Right? All clothing you put on is going to help your body. And for you, some of you here, clothing is doing a lot of help for your body. Let's not kid anybody here. But what clothing is going to do is to help your body hide your soul. But it's also going to represent a betrayal because there's a lie going on. What's the lie? The lie is that your soul is getting covered up. Let's try to come a little bit more full circle now. What did I tell you that this week's portion is all about? Last week's portion was about building the Mishkan, and it told us inside are going to be these Kruvim, these two childlike figures, which are going to be on top of the ark, and the sound of God will come out. And this week's portion is all about the clothing that the Kohen Gadol, are going to use. So now you realize that we're dealing with some type of a reverse process whereby when God commands you to put on clothing, again, in the Garden of Eden, why do Adam and Eve put on clothing? Because they're humiliated. What does God sense? God senses the humiliation, and they put on something temporary just to cover themselves. Right? What do they put on? They put on fig leaves. And what does God give them? Animal skin, which, by the way, according to one of the commentaries, was snake skin. That the snake, the serpent, shed its skin, and God took the snake skin and made them snake skin clothing. But what's the difference between animal skin versus a fig leaf? A fig leaf covers you from being naked, which is all that a fig leaf does is it stops you from being naked. What does God give them? He gives them protection. He gives them something which covers them, not which covers the nakedness, but gives them clothing. Do you realize the difference? It's one is not being naked, the other is being clothed. And the difference between the permanence of leather or skin versus the impermanence of a fig leaf should help us to begin to understand the difference, which, by the way, also gives us another unbelievable lesson, that even when man sins and man's feeling that he's naked is an indication of the alienation which is taking place because of man's rebellion against God, which therefore requires clothing, which is called beged bigadim, which means betrayal. Even there, God gives us clothing in order to take care of us and to keep us warm and protect us from the elements, especially when we're going to leave the Garden of Eden and go enter into a very frightening world. But at that point, clothing is either a symbol of a betrayal, or clothing is a symbol of God's compassion. But what is clothing not yet at this point? It's not a mitzvah yet. It's not a commandment. But don't you realize now that in order to fix the situation, God is now going to command us put on this kind of clothing. Did you realize what kind of act of kindness this is? And also realize the dichotomy. The Kohen Gadol, the high priest, will go into the Holy of Holies, see the Kruvim, see the innocence which is naked, but God's not going to ask him to go in and take off all your clothes when you're in there. What's God going to say? I'm going to command you now to put on particular clothing. I'm going to command you now to do that which you need to do to retain your own dignity. And at that moment, the clothing becomes a commandment. When the clothing becomes a commandment, man can walk in feeling good about himself. And once you feel good about yourself, then you can fix the relationship with yourself, and then you can fix the relationship with God, and then you can fix the relationship with your fellow man. And can I tell you a little secret about the Kohen Gadol, which is perhaps remarkable and only now makes sense? It only now makes sense to me also, don't worry. I make this stuff as I go on. I always prepare a different class, and then I talk about something else. One of the laws about being a Kohen Gadol, and it's the only person in Judaism that this law applies to. Do you know what it is? Exactly. You have to be married. What kind of funny law is that? You have to be married to be a Kohen Gadol, because that's a part of it. If the Kohen Gadol is trying to fix the world, trying to fix himself, the relationship with God, one of the elements has to be that there is a relationship there. There is a relationship there with somebody else. That's part of being whole. No one else in Judaism must be married. Kohen Gadol, if he's not, but they even say that they have to prepare a replacement Kohen Gadol in case something happens to his wife. So there's a stand-in, because he can't be Kohen Gadol. So perhaps this is really what it's about. But you realize now that having the temple is not about, let's go back to the beginning, it's not about God being homeless. God isn't homeless. God has many places to live. Someone once asked one of the great Hasidic rabbis, the Kutzker Rebbe, where is God? You know what he answered? Wherever you let him be. Right? There is an infinite amount of places for God to hang out. It's not a problem that God doesn't have a place to crash. Okay? Every single person has the ability of taking God into his life, taking God into his home. God says, if you build it, I will come. If you build it, Asuli Mikdash V'Shachanti Bitocham, I will dwell within you. But that's what the Garden of Eden was. It was a place that God was dwelling. But what did we do when we were sin? When we sinned? We ran away from God. We became alienated from God. But in the process, we ran away from ourselves. We ran away from our spouses. We ran away from our soulmates. We ran away from everything. But the process of fixing it means we need to identify our souls. We need to feel good about our souls. Again, in this world, I don't want anyone to misunderstand me. We wear clothing, it covers up. But we have to realize that even within the clothing, there's an act of betrayal. And we need to wear the types of clothing that allows our souls to express themselves properly. Don't ask me to define this. I won't. We need to feel that instead of just doing what everybody does, we need to realize that ultimately we are souls, that God gave us an incredible gift, and knowing that our souls can't just walk around without bodies, God gave us bodies for our souls to have as clothing, and then God gave even more compassion, said you want to cover up even more, so cover up the bodies where your soul, which is clothing itself for the soul. But on the other hand, don't make the mistake of thinking that you are your clothing, and don't make the mistake of thinking that you are your body. Realize that you are your soul. And if you want to start fixing it, listen to your soul, learn your soul, understand your soul, and then hopefully you'll get to a point that you'll be able to share your soul as well. When you get to that point, you're able to make the world just like the Garden of Eden again. And I'll just end with one thought. One of the blessings that we say under the chuppah, that we say when a couple get married, is that they should be happy as the creation that was in the Garden of Eden. That's the ultimate relationship. Listen, I've joked many times, ultimate relationship is Adam and Eve because neither of them had a mother-in-law. But that's just a joke. It's that at that point, Adam and Eve, there were no previous relationships. Eve didn't kiss Adam and just think, oh, you know, he reminds me of the smell of some other guy, or he kisses better than this. There's no other people there in the background. There's no one else in the memory. There's also incredible innocence in that. And Adam and Eve are able to get to this point of innocence. But I think the point of the temple is that even though we live in a terribly corrupt world, we need to find our own temples. We need to find our own kruvim. We need to find our own images. And we need to be able to work on it, because it won't happen unless you work on it. But we need to know that the Torah is teaching us that we have an ability of refinding our own innocence. And when we refind our innocence, you know what happens? At that point, we're no longer homeless because we find our home. Shabbat Shalom.